This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
My guest today is Melanie Spence, a nursing student at the University of Toronto and a member of Health for All, a grassroots organization in Canada fighting for health for all, irrespective of immigration status, comprised of a multidisciplinary group of migrants, healthcare professionals, students, activists, and allies. On Friday, the Federal Court of Appeal upheld a ruling from earlier this summer demanding that the Conservative government reverse its cuts to refugee health care. On October 31st, Judge Wyman Webb rejected the government's request to delay reinstating the interim federal health program, leaving Ottawa until November the 4th to restore access to the benefits. I spoke with Melanie Spence about the decision via telephone on Sunday evening.
So, Melanie, the federal government's cuts to refugee health care that have been in effect for just over 2 years were struck down by a federal court in July. They were ordered to reinstate the benefits by November the 4th. Now, the government was appealing the ability to overturn their cuts, but that has been struck down on Friday. So the government has been ordered to reverse the cuts by Tuesday, the initial time period set out in July. How big a victory is that for refugees and their doctors?
Well, I think it's an incredible victory, and I think it speaks to the amazing grassroots mobilization that we've seen amongst healthcare providers and also amongst migrant justice advocates and migrants themselves.
In July, federal court judge Anne McTavish struck down the changes as cruel and unusual punishment and gave Ottawa 4 months until November the 4th to remedy the situation. Was the appeal on the part of the government just a stalling tactic?
Well, it's, I mean, we can never know for certain, but it could very well be. I think the government tried to argue that 4 months was not enough time to turn around those cuts, when in fact we know that the government has implemented significant policy changes on a much shorter time frame than that. So it would seem that that is a bluff, and that is certainly what the court decided on Friday when they rejected the government's application for a stay, which means that now the government is obligated to essentially rescind the cuts that we saw to the interim federal health program in 2012 to the version that was there before that would be in line with the fair treatment of refugees.
Now, the federal government still has the ability, as I understand it, to launch a formal appeal, but still have to reverse the cuts. What does this mean? As I understand it, the case goes to the Federal Court of Appeal, and they decide whether it goes back to the Supreme Court of Canada. So what happens in between?
It remains to be seen. We're not sure yet. We haven't heard anything from the government yet. This decision just came down on Friday, but by Tuesday we'll have heard something. I mean, to stay within the spirit of the court's decision in the summer, the federal government really needs to rescind the cuts and restore the IFH program back to the pre-2012 cuts. But we don't know yet exactly what the government will come back with. It's entirely possible that they might try to find some kind of legal loophole. But we're all waiting to see what's going to be announced this Tuesday, November 4th. And I think you're correct that we can expect the government will move forward with a formal appeals process.
Even prior to July, when the cuts were reversed, some of the provinces had agreed to cover some of the costs out of their own coffers. How much pressure from the provinces on the federal government do you think there is right now?
I think there is an amount of pressure. I mean, certainly in Ontario, there was a lot of grassroots mobilization. Health for All, the organization that I'm a part of, we led the way with our Fill the Gap campaign, which we launched after the IFH cuts were announced, urging Deb Matthews, the Ontario Health Minister, and the government to step in and fill that gap to provide necessary health care for refugees. And I think that a year after we launched that campaign, the Ontario government did, in fact, fill the gap. So that was a significant victory for grassroots mobilization. And in her statement, Deb Matthews stated that it was the responsibility of the federal government to provide health care for refugees, and that while the Ontario government would fill the gap, ultimately the call was for the federal government to rescind the cuts and have returned to its obligations to this population.
What were the changes to the interim federal health program that were introduced by the federal government in 2012?
The changes were quite drastic, and they were quite sudden, which is partly why I think we saw such a huge kind of unprecedented mobilization, especially amongst healthcare providers who aren't always the first ones in the streets. So before the 2012 cuts, first of all, the IFH program covered healthcare for refugees that is basically similar to what any low-income Canadian would receive on a social assistance program. So this would include healthcare such as doctor and hospital visits, as well as medications and access to basic dental and vision care. What we saw after the cuts was that privately sponsored refugees and refugee claimants all lost coverage for medicines, dental, vision care through the IFH. Those groups still had access to hospital and doctor coverage. And then alongside the interim federal health program cuts, we saw the implementation of another policy under Bill C-31. And what this did was create, distribute refugees according to country of origin and create a list of so-called designated countries of origin. These are safe countries that the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration believes should not be producing refugees to Canada. Now, of course, we can appreciate that this policy dramatically understates the complex social political divisions within countries. But essentially what this did was, as far as the IFH cuts go, any refugee claimant from one of these so-called safe countries was no longer eligible for any health care, essentially, only something called public health and safety coverage, which is really just intended to protect the Canadian population and is about treating only infectious disease, not really about the care of that person themselves.
As you stated earlier, doctors and nurses and other health care providers mobilized in the streets with, you know, rallies and demonstrations. And that was unprecedented. They'd never done anything like that before, but then again, they were never pushed to do something like this either. Discuss the mobilization over the last couple of years, and do you think that that was a factor in Judge McTavish's decision to strike down the changes in July?
I absolutely think that that mobilization was a factor in Judge McTavish's decision. And as you say, it was unprecedented and prompted, I think, in part by the unilateral method in which these cuts were implemented. So all of a sudden, in April of 2012, there was just an announcement that said, as of June 2012, these cuts are going to be implemented and they're drastic. And so healthcare providers, especially those who work with migrant populations, sort of threw up their hands and said, well, wait a minute, what about our professional responsibilities and obligations? What about the fact that we are the ones working with this population? What am I to do with a patient that I've been seeing for X amount of time who you're now saying will not be eligible for care? And it's worth noting, too, that what these cuts did was really create a lot of confusion amongst providers and amongst claimants, which meant really, unfortunately, that a lot of claimants who were, in fact, eligible under the new program were turned away. Many providers just said, I'm sorry, we can't deal with refugee patients because we don't understand how this works. Providers are also now obligated to seek pre-approval for treatment. So it really was just kind of a mess. And I think that's part of the reason why we saw the mobilization on the scale that we did. And it really did, and I speak as a healthcare provider myself, I'm a nursing student at the University of Toronto, I think it really did push the boundaries of what we understand traditionally as patient advocacy from a one-to-one thing to an involvement in a political sphere.
Yes, because I remember listening to a couple of doctors at either a press conference or a rally who said that they would be in the midst of a routine physical with a patient, and they'd have to get on the phone and find out if this or that could be approved or not. It mm-hmm. really created all kinds of barriers, almost to the point that there were doctors who didn't want the hassle of having to deal with a refugee because it had become so bureaucratic.
Precisely. And we've seen, in fact, like there are many documented cases of the detrimental effects that these cuts have had on the health of refugees. To give an example, there was a woman who arrived pregnant in Canada, 36 weeks pregnant, who had an OB and was told that she could no longer receive care and to bring $3,000 to her next appointment. However, weeks later, she was told, in fact, oh, we were wrong, your IFH is valid. In the meantime, that woman experienced a significant amount of stress. There's another case of a teenager with post-traumatic stress disorder and previous suicide attempts who had valid IFH coverage but was cut off of essential psychiatric medications. So these are just but a few examples of how these cuts have affected the lives and health of refugees.
So the last 2 years have been very difficult both for refugees and for doctors who care for them in their practices or as volunteers at refugee healthcare clinics. I remember speaking with one doctor who had told me that the refugee healthcare clinic where he volunteered was overwhelmed. And I think that probably speaks to most clinics. Has that been your experience as well?
Yes, it has. I think many clinics have been overwhelmed, and it created such an immediate state of confusion as well that unfortunately led to a lot of unnecessary denial of care. And there are only a few clinics in Toronto, for example, that are that specifically treat refugee populations or undocumented people. So aside from that, there are only a few other resources that people can access, and it really did lead to a lot of denial of care.
Even if the federal government in the end ends up restoring the cuts, can they go after refugees in other ways? Because, of course, this was just one example of the government's attack on refugees. What are other kinds of things? Because, you know, looking at the big picture here.
Yeah. Well, and the big picture is grim at the moment, and what it shows us is increasingly regressive policy developments on a federal level with respect to treatment of refugees. So we're seeing the refugees and other migrants have an increasing precarity of status. So it's much easier now to lose status. It's harder to gain status, and there are less benefits associated with any given status, for example, like the IFH cuts. We're also seeing a real policing of who can get into Canada. So the designated country of origin policy would be an example of that. And there are, I mean, to give just another example, there was a two-year moratorium on the sponsorship of grandparents and parents in 2012, and that's now been lifted, but there's now a higher income requirement, and it's the cap is much lower than it was before. And we're also seeing just generally an anti-immigrant sentiment and a denial of rights to immigrants. So this is fueled by language such as bogus refugees, you know, claiming gold-plated healthcare or queue jumpers. This is all language intended to divide and conquer, really, within the migrant population and between migrants and Canadians.
Yeah, of course, that leads to my next question, which was the Fed's claim that the refugee healthcare system is abused, that refugees get better healthcare than others in Canada, and that it's too expensive. How do you respond to those claims?
Well, to start with the last point, the projected savings, and by the way, we don't know how they came up with those numbers. We've inquired but haven't ever received a response. The projected savings from the IFH cuts were $20 million a year, which would amount to $100 million over 5 years. And this is really, frankly, a drop in the bucket. Like, this is nothing. So it seems that it would be politically motivated. And as far as the claim that refugees should not receive healthcare benefits that are greater than what Canadians receive, we have to remember that who we're talking about here are a group of incredibly vulnerable people who arrive, generally speaking, to Canada destitute and without the financial resources that we would need to access healthcare services either privately or like through a private insurance or out of pocket. So it's only fair to compare refugees to what we would give any low-income Canadian, which is healthcare, doctor visits, hospital visits, medications, eye, vision, dental care, with the understanding that this group of people are not going to be able to access care otherwise. So it is, in fact, really unfair to ask these people to pay out of pocket or to do anything other than provide them with full healthcare benefits.
Other than financial reasons, Melanie, explain why it's so important for refugees to have access to these services without cost, especially when many are suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, many who've had physical conditions that have been left untreated in their home countries because they may have been forced into hiding, or they're coming from a war-torn country, because I don't think a lot of people understand that.
Yeah, it is very important. And anyone who, healthcare providers, for example, who work on the front line with refugees would know that, but I think you're correct that perhaps a majority of the Canadian population doesn't quite grasp that. I mean, if we haven't had those experiences, then I think it would be a hard thing to understand. But you can imagine, I mean, the situations under which people claim refugee status are life-threatening. So, I mean, the claim that refugees, are coming to Canada simply for healthcare is just atrocious. People are coming to Canada because they're being targeted. They're undergoing political persecution or any other number of terrible things that I think a lot of Canadians couldn't even imagine. And so you're right that medical conditions that need immediate attention, like post-traumatic stress. There's a lot of instances too of women who are pregnant, not being able to access prenatal care. We know that access to prenatal care is so vital and important for mothers and for babies, and so for those children growing up. And really, if we don't provide that kind of care up front, what we're going to see is what we have seen, which is an increase in emergency room visits. And that's a situation that no one wants. And I think, yeah, we really do need to appreciate that refugees are not coming to Canada to take advantage of our health and social benefits. Refugees are coming to Canada not because they want to necessarily leave where they're from and leave everything behind. They're coming to Canada because they need to. They're being targeted. And so we need to recognize that this is a uniquely vulnerable population and provide them with health and social supports in order to make a life in Canada.
Melanie, compare the costs of a visit to the ER versus being treated on a regular basis in a clinic. Because, of course, you mentioned earlier, that's where they're ending up if they are denied the treatment because of the cuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, the cost of the ER can be exorbitant, and it depends entirely on the procedure. One of the things that's especially troubling is that hospitals, for example, in the GTA, tend to charge people higher than what they bill OHIP for. So a procedure that you or I might get under OHIP has a certain cost, and oftentimes hospitals will charge above that cost. The other thing that hospitals do is, not all of them, but some of them, is they have registration fees. And these are arbitrary numbers. Again, they range perhaps $400 or $500. Some hospitals have them and some don't. But while people come to the hospital, they cannot necessarily be denied care, but are sometimes de facto denied care because the hospitals insist that those without health insurance pay this hospital registration fee up front, which, as I said, could be $400 or $500. And many people, rather than pay that fee, actually leave the hospital. So in terms of how much a procedure might cost, for example, there was a case of a young girl who had to have an emergency appendectomy, so had to have her appendix removed. And that cost $16,000.
Wow.
This girl actually was not a refugee. She was a new immigrant, and her family had come to Ottawa. And new immigrants to Canada, if you're coming to Ontario and a few other provinces in the country, you have to undergo a 3-month wait period before your OHIP comes into effect. And this is incredibly stressful for a lot of families. So, for example, this young girl, you know, didn't know that her appendix was going to rupture before their 3 months wait period was up. That's, in fact, what happened. And then the family received a bill for $16,000.
And, of course, another factor that people may not be aware of is the fact that it could take up to 2 years for your refugee claim to be decided. So it's not as if that claim is going to be decided very quickly and then you can go out and start working and earning money. And of course, if your refugee claim is successful, then of course you're covered under the healthcare program with that 3 month wait, as you mentioned. But if that claim can take up to 2 years, that's 2 years where they need that coverage.
And actually what we saw with Bill C-31, which came into effect in 2012, which I mentioned before, this was the bill that introduced this idea of the safe countries. This bill also decreased processing times for refugee claimants from now it's between 30 to 60 days.
Okay.
That is the amount of time, and it does depend whether you make a port of claim or inland claim. But
with appeals, though, it could be extended longer. Is that correct?
With appeals, it could be extended longer. That's correct.
Yeah,
I believe that refugee claimants from these safe countries are not eligible for appeal.
Okay.
That's my understanding. But you're correct that in any case, people will... The point is that people could well be here either sort of under a temporary status while they're waiting for their claim to be heard or in the appeals process or non-status and be struggling to have work in other ways to sustain their lives and livelihoods. Absolutely. Another thing that's recently come down is Bill C-585. And this was a bill... it was a private member's bill. We've seen a real increase in private member's bills being introduced by the Harper government. And what it essentially did was it would allow for the provinces to institute a minimum residency requirement with respect to the provision of social assistance. So basically what that means is that it would allow provinces to deny refugees social assistance, whereas before that has never been an option in terms of the federal money transfer. Now, there was a huge outcry. This came out, I think, about a month ago. There was another grassroots mobilization, huge response, which actually successfully delayed the reading of the bill in Parliament a couple times. But now what the federal government has done is rolled this bill into an omnibus budget bill that's really quickly making its way through Parliament. So I think this is just another example where, I mean, if you're a refugee to this country and let's say the province of Ontario institutes a minimum residency requirement to access social assistance, what are you going to do? How are you going to support yourself? You're trying to establish yourself. Maybe you're incurring healthcare debt because you have to pay out of pocket for necessary medications. I mean, now under the ISH cuts, chemo drugs are no longer covered, and people have actually died as a result of that. So this is real life and death stuff.
What kinds of numbers were we talking about in terms of the interim federal health program? That are, you know, numbers of people that are on it at any given time, roughly.
Well, now it's become a bit more complicated because it depends on, there are now these new categories.
Okay.
Of refugees. But, for example, if we look at the numbers, I think from 2012, mm-hmm. The accepted refugee claimants constituted maybe about 10,000 people. So those people would be eligible for OHIP. But if we look at people who are more temporary status, so who are from these designated countries of origin, for example, I think the numbers would be like more like 8,000 to 10,000. So we're talking about a significant number of people who basically have no health care. And in Toronto, there are an estimated 100,000 people without insurance, without health insurance.
Is there the concern that if the federal government does reverse the cuts as instructed, that they lose their appeal, that they simply come out with a new bill,
mm-hmm.
something similar, but not exactly the same, use that as a backdoor to cut health care for refugees, and then wait for health care providers to launch another charter challenge, which will take roughly 2 years to be heard and a decision made, and that they'll just keep playing this game and hope that you people will get tired and go away.
Well, we'll never get tired and we'll never go away.
Good.
but I think it is a concern, and I definitely wouldn't put it past this government to do that. All I can say is that we're all watching. The legal experts are watching as well, and they're prepared to recognize if the government is, you know, if the government tries to implement a new program that is not in the spirit of the July decision. And so I think we just need to watch and wait, but I think we're certainly ready to act.
Mm-hmm. Because it's not as if Stephen Harper doesn't have an already frosty relationship with the Supreme Court, and it's not beyond the realm of possibility that he could thumb his nose, figuratively speaking, at the Supreme Court of Canada by introducing something else. We're also looking at an election. I somehow think that we're looking at the spring now more than a year from now when it was initially been set for. I'd be very surprised if it wasn't held in the spring. How do you think the upcoming election in 2015 will influence what happens with regards to the interim federal health program for refugees?
Mm-hmm. Well, the government only has until Tuesday to figure out what they're going to do with respect to the July decision. So they're going to have to act a little bit more quickly than that. But I think, generally speaking, we've seen this government use the divide and conquer strategy before. We've seen that with the temporary foreign worker program. We've seen that really across the board with this anti-migrant sentiment. So I wouldn't be surprised if we heard more rhetoric along the lines of protecting jobs for Canadian workers and more about bogus refugees and being fair to Canadian taxpayers. That's all run-of-the-mill, and I wouldn't be surprised. And we just need to be informed and understand exactly how this is politically motivated and be prepared to fight.
Now, Melanie, I know you're not a lawyer, but can you give us an idea what kind of legal arguments the lawyers for doctors presented in their charter challenge, just in very basic layman's terms?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that what the lawyers claimed was that these cuts were unfairly targeting refugees who already constitute a vulnerable population. And I think they also made the point, too, that the projected savings do not amount to any kind of real savings, and is not a good enough reason basically to deny these people care. And I think they also pointed out that the federal government has a responsibility to this population to provide them with health care in order that they may survive and thrive in Canada.
Melanie, any final thoughts before we wrap up the interview?
Well, I just might mention that Health for All, we are continue to call for a full reversal of the IFH cuts, as well as calling for health care for all people in Canada, irrespective of immigration status. And we're also continuing to call for the reversal of this trend of increasingly regressive immigration policies that pit migrants against one another and that make it harder for people to live here and be well and healthy.
Melanie Spence, thanks so much for taking the time to interview with Rabble.ca.
Thank you, John.
For Rabble.ca, this is John Bonner. Thank you for listening to John Bonner's audio blog, hosted by Rabble.ca and the Rabble Podcast Network.